My guest today, Alexander Zajcik, is a freelance journalist who has written for The Nation, Salon, The New Republic, New York Observer, Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, International Herald Tribune, Wired, The San Francisco Chronicle, and The Believer. He has been on the staff of the New York Press, served as an investigative reporting fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center, and founded the online magazine Freezer Box from 1998 to 2008. Zajcik has also held editorial roles at the Prague Pill and the Russian tabloid The Exile. His book, Common Nonsense, Glenn Beck and the Triumph of Ignorance, was published by Wiley & Sons in June 2010. He lives in Brooklyn, where I reached him a few moments ago. Welcome, Alexander Zajcik, to Takes on the World.
Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to have you. On February 10th, you posted an article, a troubling article on Salon.com entitled Ecuador, Indigenous Tribes, Militant Resistance to Left, unquote, put that in quotes, Korea Government, which a friend of mine forwarded to me. In it, you describe a modern-day Avatar script being played out in the rainforest of Ecuador, minus the gringo hero and the blue-body natives, with a different set of foreign plunderers. I read the first four paragraphs to our listeners at the start of today's program to give them an idea of what was to come. How do you explain the government of Rafael Correa that most international left supports in the belief it's an important part of the Latin American resistance to the predations of Western imperialism heading in another direction?
It's a good question. Correa's reputation tends to rest on a foundation of not a whole lot of information sometimes in the West. When I traveled in Ecuador, I found very few veteran activists who could really understand it. I mean, most people are more likely to compare him to, certainly in the South where I was traveling for the story, were more likely to compare him to Pinochet than, say, Bolivar or some of the traditional sort of leftist icons in the region. So it's a good question. I mean, he rode to power on indigenous support. The left was sort of cautiously optimistic about his government, and he's betrayed most of the principles that you could, hold as a progressive, from indigenous rights to freedom of speech, you name it, to the environment. It's just been one horror show after another, and right now he's basically committed the country to a path of mega mining and oil development in the entirety of the Amazon. These are very fragile ecosystems inhabited by indigenous tribes who have been there for thousands and thousands of years, and anyone who raises a voice against this program is being intimidated and silenced, and in some cases losing their jobs and even going to jail.
Yet he just recently won an overwhelming re-election on the basis of the fact that, like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, he's evidently distributed Ecuador's income from its resources to raise the level of the general population. But there was, I remember, even from the very beginning, indigenous criticism going back to his initial election. It seems that from what you write, that as long as the bulk of the population are doing well, the rest, they don't care about what's going on in the indigenous parts of the country.
That's true. There's always been a divide between the mestizo and the so-called blanco populations in the coast and the Andes and the Indians in the Oriente, the Amazonian regions. And that gulf exists today. It's wide as ever. And basically, as long as these social programs benefit, the urban poor and other sectors of the population, there's not a whole lot of concern to the fact that the money funding these programs is coming from short bursts of investment, of credit, rather, from largely the Chinese government and the Chinese Development Bank for projects that are only going to last 20 years. I mean, these mining projects have lifespans of 20 to 30 years at the absolute most, and then they're gone and they're done, and the money stopped coming in, and you're left with a completely devastated environment. Sustainable agriculture is wiped out. Sustainable tourism industries, which are fledgling in the South right now, will be destroyed, and it's a very short-term sort of way of looking at development, and it also does not do anything to get away from the resource curse that has plagued Ecuador since the development of oil in the 1960s when Texaco discovered oil in the north.
And recently there was a court decision that actually in The Hague that found against the Ecuadorian government because it has not suppressed the efforts of Ecuadorians to obtain money from Chevron, billions of dollars from Chevron, which bought Texaco. And so there's it's like a on one side you see the government defending the people, on the other side you see the government participating in exploiting the people. It is difficult for those outside of Ecuador or Latin America to kind of see the complexity of the situation.
Yeah, it's complex, and it's a vexing, you know, problem. It's certainly not all black and white, this question of you know, development versus indigenous rights and the need for capital and the need to protect the environment. There's a lot of facets here, a lot of different conflicts. As for that lawsuit you mentioned, there's an $18 billion judgment against Chevron, but it's still tangled up in the courts, and there's no end in sight. Who knows how and if that will run its course.
Well, let's talk about the region in which native indigenous people call the Shuar, who I was not familiar with by name, but as you mentioned in your article, people know about them, but not their name. And the region, the Cordillera del Condor, in this incredible rainforest, which whose existence influences the entire planet in a positive way, is endangered by this mega mining project.
Yeah, the Shuar are a tribe. They're one of the four tribes that make up the Jivaro language group. Most people know them as headhunters. They came to prominence during the rubber boom for their practice of shrinking the heads of their enemies. And their ancestral grounds are the Cordilleras between Andes and the Amazon Basin. And these areas are very important because they produce an enormous amount of water, which flows east into the Amazon proper and feeds the Amazon River. So basically, they produce the headwaters of the Amazon, the most important rainforest and ecosystem on the planet, arguably, so-called lungs of the earth. So by tearing up these cordilleras, we're going to be disrupting the hydraulic cycle that feeds the Amazon and poisoning it. And we're not sure exactly what the long-term consequences will be, but there's a lot of threats to these headwaters, not just mining in Ecuador, although this is an important one. There's also a bunch of hydro dam projects in Peru that are slated on the Marañón River, which is a major feeder of the Amazon. So there's threats on a lot of fronts, and it's a very dangerous thing to be messing with, this very fragile and complex ecosystem at the beginning of the Amazon.
And they say there are like 300, they were discovered like 300 minerals. It's like one of the problems of the people living there is they're living, it's very much like the Congo. They're fortunate enough to live in an area that is so rich in minerals that are needed by the developed world that their lives are considered throwaways.
Right. So in that sense, we all are characters in this drama because it's industrial society that has the thirst and the need for these minerals. In the case of the Condor in southeast Ecuador, although it's mostly gold and copper, and gold is not necessarily a necessity. It's most of the stuff is going to jewelry. In the case of copper, it's being developed by a Chinese consortium led by the Chinese Railway Company, and that's going to develop Chinese rail and also Chinese industrial infrastructure, copper being a very important base metal for all sorts of things.
And now, one of the things that was surprising and troubling was you mentioned how Vandana Shiva who is considered perhaps the leading environmentalist in the world in the struggle, people struggle against exploitation of resources, was in Ecuador, Quito, to praise Correa, and she was confronted by his critics. Maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah, I was very surprised to see that. She's someone that I have a lot of respect for and generally is an extremely informed person. But I saw her in the capacity of an official representative of the government. She had just accepted a post of goodwill ambassador for Yasuni National Park in the north, which is Korea government's kind of showcase environmental project and conservation area. But it's kind of a distraction when you consider what's going on in the rest of the country, which he's basically parceled out to foreign oil and mining interests. And she really seemed taken aback when local indigenous groups and environmentalists kind of challenged her on this. She didn't seem to have much knowledge at all about what was actually taking place in the rest of Ecuador. She just kind of had parachuted in, gotten the government tour, was flattered, was happy to announce this post. And I think since then she's probably come to appreciate the complexity of the situation in Ecuador a little better. It's not just her. I also mentioned John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, who's also someone with a lot of experience in Ecuador, and he has sung the praises of the new constitution there and of Correa without any reference to these other projects which undermine the new constitution.
Actually, I've interviewed John Perkins about that book when it came out, and I was disappointed to see that. It seems if it's some country other than the United States or perhaps Britain doing the exploiting, people don't take it as seriously, but China is out there, and Africa as well, Latin America, keeping a lower profile than the United States because it doesn't send its military out there to enforce whatever the government happens to be in place.
Right. Although I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about China and Latin America in the coming years and other countries as well. And the literature is starting to bubble up, but it's definitely going to be a bigger story. As for them sending the military, they didn't really have to because they've become so important to these countries that they're funding right now that the militaries of those countries are almost put at the service of these foreign companies. For example, Ecuadorian military and police have been involved in repressing protests in Ecuador. Private security forces run by former army and police are, you know, abundant down there, and they usually have ties to the government. So there's not a lack of options when it comes to force.
Let's go back a little bit more and tell about the people who live in this region, the Shuar. How do you pronounce that?
Shuar.
They have a practice of shrinking skulls, which people would think they had disappeared. But it's called Zansa. Is that the practice, what they call it?
Zansa. Yeah.
This has not disappeared, evidently. It's something that they keep in reserve in order to defend their territory.
They take it very seriously. It's a very old tradition. The skull is actually removed, which is what allows for the shrinkage of the rest of the head. It's filled with sand, and it's a very complex process, and it's boiled over the course of days. A lot of people are under the impression that it disappeared in the early 20th century, but when I was traveling through the Condor, I spoke to people who said, no, in fact, when we were fighting the Peruvians in our territory in the 1990s, which is pretty recently, they would sever the heads of fallen soldiers and take them back to their villages for the ceremony, which is a way of sort of keeping the spirits of the invaders from returning to the area and inflicting damage is kind of the idea.
Now, are they, as a people, united on this project, against the project?
For the most part, yes. But there are young members of the indigenous communities who sort of see this as a chance to make money, and they're starting to think more in terms of a market economy because they've grown up with more contact with the modern state, and they don't have a whole lot of options. But overwhelmingly, the Shuar of all generations are opposed to this. And you're starting to see more militant statements of unity and opposition emerging from these communities.
So you spent a month there. What brought you down there in the first place? How did you find out about this?
I kind of have been following indigenous conflicts in the region for a while. And last March 2012, there was a 400-mile march from Zamora, southern capital, to Quito. and there were conflicts in Quito when they got there, and I got a couple statements of Korea opposing those protesting the mining operations, and it was clear that, you know, this was one of the more interesting such conflicts. But there's many of them. I mean, they're bubbling up in every single country in the region that has any kind of rainforest or indigenous population, which is most of them. I mean, it can be replicated dozens and dozens of times.
Now, you mentioned how important it is to get this story out because it is being suppressed, it seems like, on all sides, because we have a long history of within the left of people having their heroes who they don't look at very carefully, say going back to Joseph Stalin, for example, but in the more modern times, and so when they commit crimes against their own people, there's a tendency to look away, and so it doesn't seem like at the moment, for example, Korea dedicated his victory to Hugo Chavez.
Mm-hmm.
And if Chavez dies, Korea will try to assume his mantle, it seems. And mm-hmm. the international left that doesn't know what's going on or doesn't want to know what's going on in the Cordillera del Conde, will hail Korea, and so will the Western governments who are happy to see rainforest destroyed and profits made, because it keeps the corporate capitalist system going.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm not sure Ecuador is big enough to be the sort of leader of any bloc, but he will certainly try to increase his role and profile in the event of Chavez's death. I think, you know, there's not a whole lot of reporting out of that area generally, so it's not surprising that people in the States, people on the left, see him sheltering Assange, for example, and think, okay, that's all I need to know. He's obviously shares all my values and beliefs. But you just pry open the box a little bit about what's happening in Ecuador, and you'll be demystified very, very quickly. I've spoken to so many activists down there who have been harassed, who have friends facing long-term jail time, journalists who've lost their jobs, who have been harangued by the president on television. He uses state media to attack any journalist who questions his policies, and specifically in terms of the environment. But across the board, he does not work dissent very well at all. So it would be very, very difficult for anyone to spend much time researching his rule and still see him as some sort of progressive icon of any sort.
You know, this, the region which I was not aware of, as you describe in your article, which I do recommend, that came out in Ceylon, what was it, February 10th?
I believe so, yeah.
Because it goes in a lot of detail, but I'd like to actually go back into what this rainforest contains. I see you spoke with a biologist, Alfredo Luna, who crashed in the area nearly 20 years ago, in a crash that killed two of his colleagues, and he describes the variety of plants and flowers that live in this particular region. It's quite extraordinary. He says, there is more diversity of life in 1 hectare of the Condor than all North America combined. That's an incredible statement.
Yeah, it's an incredible region. It has this patchwork, this very dense and very unique patchwork of microclimates because of the altitudes and because of the wind patterns and because of all the water and just the nature of the soils. All of these things come together to produce this unbelievably rich hotspot. And we're only sort of beginning to understand what's there. It was only surveyed for the first time in the 90s. I mean, it's got 40 kinds of orchid alone, many of which are, you know, only found in this small area. It's got mammals science doesn't know, plants, all kinds of things that could just be incredibly useful to the human race. I mean, sometimes we have this mythology of the Amazon holding magic bullet keys to cancer or AIDS. I mean, this is the kind of place where we're going to find that stuff. It's completely unique, not just to Ecuador, but to the whole of Latin America. And the idea that it's going to be destroyed and polluted and ripped up before we even know what's there is just, you know, heartbreaking. It's scary.
And then we have this that the condor sits on a mass of aquifers containing a fair chunk of the continent's fresh water that comes out from everywhere. It feeds the Amazon with mining there. There's no way that they can prevent, like, fracking here, but this is like fracking on steroids. The destruction of that water supply, the contamination of that water supply, it would seem.
Yeah, I mean, when you have that much water churning, the idea that you're going to be able to isolate and protect huge tailing ponds that hold millions and millions of tons of contaminant, you know, mercury, all these nasty toxins, the idea that you're just going to be able to keep it in one place without it feeding in, seeping into the rest of the area is just absurd. I mean, on the face of it, no one can really believe that. I mean, so, yeah, it's extremely dangerous, and the contaminant is going to seep all the way into the Amazonian basin, and there's going to be a lot of it. These projects are enormous open sky mining projects. Entire mountains are going to be cleared out. The tailing ponds themselves are like huge lakes of poison, and they're, in some cases, very near, less than a kilometer away from important rivers that feed in to the Maranon, which goes right into the Amazon River.
I've seen, and many of the listeners perhaps have seen, the films of what Texaco left behind when it was drilling for oil there. It was like an Avatar nightmare. And but it's out of the reach of the Western mind. But within Latin America, is there attention now being paid to this? Or is the political ramifications trump the willingness to take on the Correa government?
There's not a whole lot of opposition. There was a 7-party alliance of leftist parties that did not get a lot of support in last week's elections in Ecuador. However, I will say that there is a growing opposition movement uniting indigenous populations in the various countries. Like, for example, in Peru, the Indians talk to Ecuadorian Indians, and they share information and strategies, and they tell them, you know, don't believe what they're telling you, look at our experience. And they're starting to communicate better, and that is hopefully something that can grow with support from other parts of the world. But for the most part, they do not have anywhere near anything like the upper hand, and they're struggling, and they don't have a lot of support. I mean, they can appeal to international bodies that are supposed to protect international conventions on indigenous rights and consultation, but at the end of the day, these organizations are powerless compared to the state.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Jeffrey. It's Deborah, and I thank you for having this guest. It's so very important. Having grown up in northern Canada, this story is just so sickeningly familiar. It's like they've got the methodology down, and it's really easy to divide Native people, especially when some of them are living in the cities, with this short-term equity gain, and then it's gone, and then the culture's gone, and it's all very familiar. But I wanted to ask your guest about and also encourage listeners to be familiar with the work of Jeremy Narby, who's a pretty famous person to have worked in that area and with the Shuar. And where does the role of their land entitlement, which he worked very hard to secure for quite a lot of acreage in the Amazon, where does their land entitlement fit into the role of the federal government? What rights do they have to their land? And what does your guest think concerned people in this country can do? Do they think boycott methodology is best? Or how can we most exert pressure? Would the parent companies of Murdoch, et cetera, be useful? What does he think is a good strategy? Thanks so much.
Thanks for Deborah. Yeah, you heard the call, your question?
Hello? Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Yep, hi. Yeah, as for the land issue, it's not always so simple. I mean, in many cases, the indigenous communities do own title to the land, and they no one can affect where they live. In other cases, there's overlapping sort of regimes where the land they've been on for so long is actually owned by, you know, a distant landlord in Cuenca who can sell it to the companies. In some cases, the government can say this is in the interest of national security, this is a national priority, therefore sort of like an eminent domain thing comes into play. And then also there's the question of this being a spillover kind of phenomenon where even if the actual community is not developed, you know, the water that they depend on for life is destroyed because the mine property is adjacent or downstream just a little bit, or upstream rather. So it's not always as simple as just we have this land, it's protected. This is a sort of, you know, the whole ecology of the region is going to be disrupted here, and the way of life is going to be changed because as the agricultural economy is destroyed, people are going to be forced to take jobs in the mines. Then you have this sort of social wastage, as the caller mentioned, that the culture goes away very quickly. You have the rise of gambling, alcoholism, prostitution, all these things that never existed in these indigenous communities start to flood in as the company comes into the area. So it's not just as simple as property rights. As for the second part of the question, you know, that's kind of the big one. I wish I had an answer for it. I don't know how good a boycott of Kinross Gold or the Chinese Railway Company would be. I think at this point it's important to just talk about this until people are aware of what's going on down there. I mean, it looks like if you look at the concession maps in the Amazonian regions, in the Amazonian countries right now, it looks like the most advanced lung cancer you've ever seen in your life. I mean, every single region has just been boxed off for oil and mining concessions. It's not like the lungs of the earth are, as someone put it to me, or we're smoking in them. It's like we're smoking through the trachea at this point. I mean, there's very little land that has not been targeted for industrial exploration or development. And I just think people need to really be aware of the extremity of the situation and start there. And hopefully things kind of take their course. But right now, I don't think there's enough awareness for exactly how serious this is.
Well, perhaps the romanticism surrounding Korea on the part of the left progressive movement can be penetrated, and Correa could find out that he's not the hero that people thought he was. I mean, it's not a boycott so much, but a removal of the rose-colored glasses to look at Ecuador as it is, and not as he has presented it. One interesting part of your article, you wrote about your guide. When you were in Ecuador, was a 57-year-old Shuar chief named Domingo Anquash. Tell us a little bit about him.
Domingo Anquash is sort of the face of the Shuar resistance. The resistance down in the south is an alliance between indigenous communities and the mestizo farmers, the Capaceños, who were settled in the region in the 1950s by the government. They have a shared interest in keeping mining projects from happening because it will destroy their agricultural lifestyle and their livelihoods. But Domingo's kind of the face of the Shuar half of the equation. He's an interesting guy. He went north to work in the Texaco oil fields in the 70s as a young man. He wanted to travel and, you know, see the world a little bit. And what he saw so horrified him, he came back and basically devoted his life to making sure that that would never happen in the south. So as soon as it became obvious that the government was pushing to open the south to foreign mining concerns, he became active, and he was in charge of leading the mining sweeps in 2006 and 2007, in which the Shuar basically swarmed exploratory mining camps and kicked them all out. And there was a standoff with the army that lasted several days at one point. They came in with spears and drove out the camps, and then Correa was elected, and everything kind of paused until they sorted out the new constitution and the new mining law. And then once it became clear that Correa was going to fall on the side, heavily on the side of mining, then tensions began to rise. And right now they're probably nearing some sort of boiling point again.
Are there Are there, let's say, groups of Shuar who kind of meet together because there's a, what's the size of the area that they cover?
They're kind of spread out over the Condor, which is, several hundred square miles. And but yeah, they get together quite a bit. They have community meetings at pretty much every level, regional meetings. They're also meeting with other indigenous groups in Ecuador and Latin America. So the meetings are happening all the time at every level, in Quito as well.
Oh, we have a board's lit up here. We have time for one more call. Hello, welcome to Takes on the World. Got to keep it short.
Yeah, okay. Pretty much had a comment. First of all, I'd like to thank your guest for the great work he's doing, you know, getting everything out there that we can hear. The things that I hear, like in the next 30 years, there's going to be a few more billion people on this planet. You know, and it makes me think this is almost frivolous because there's no way we can stop any of this if we're going to keep adding billions of people on the planet. We're going to have these things or not, you know. So that's just my comment. How do we slow down the growth of this planet if it's possible? Thank you.
Thanks for your call. And Alex?
Yeah, I mean, it's a
big question.
Big one. But certainly how you feed that many people is not destroying the natural environment, I guess, is one thing to keep in mind.
Any last comment on what you'd like people to do about this?
Just spread the word. There's some good organizations out there who work with indigenous groups, the Pachamama Alliance in the Bay Area, Survival International in London, all the various rainforest groups. They're worth supporting, and join up to their email lists and just talk to people and start there.
Well, thanks so much, Alex Kachik, for being our guest today and writing that article. The article, again, was Ecuador Indigenous Tribes Militant Resistance to Left Correa Government. It was actually posted, written on February 10th, and so on Salon.com. I suggest people read that and send it to your friends and get active on this. Thanks so much for being our guest today.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye.